Members of Congress also have had a few things to say about embryonic stem cells. Some say they hold the potential for medical miracles. Others claim it's a moral abomination to use them. Either way, human embryonic stem cells captured headlines in the past decade in a way few areas of scientific research have before. NPR's Joe Palca looks at the policies under three presidents.
Embryonic stem cells have remarkable properties. They can grow indefinitely in the lab, and they can turn into any cell type in the body. But to get them, you must destroy an embryo. Scientists first showed that it was possible to grow human embryonic stem cells in 1998. Under normal circumstances, other scientists would have rushed in to study the new cells. But there was a problem. Because of congressional restrictions, federal money couldn't be used for research that harms an embryo. President Bill Clinton interpreted that to mean scientists could use federal money to study embryonic stem cells once they were growing in the lab, provided they used private money to create them. But before President Clinton's decision took effect, George W. Bush became president. One of his first acts as president was to put that decision on hold so he could reconsider it. In August 2001, the new president decided that despite his finding the research morally troubling,
I have concluded that we should allow federal funds to be used for research on these existing stem cell lines, where the life and death decision has already been made.
The existing stem cell lines turned out to be a dozen or so lines that had already been made using non-federal dollars. They were made from embryos that would have been discarded by fertility clinics. The decision pleased no one. Scientists were upset by the restrictions. Critics of the research were upset the president had allowed any federal money to be spent on embryonic stem cells. Both sides went to work to change the policy. A bipartisan Congress voted to ease federal restrictions. President Bush vetoed the legislation. Congressional opponents continued to push for a total ban on the research, and states got into the fray. In California, voters authorized spending $3 billion over 10 years for embryonic stem cell research. Candidate Barack Obama promised to ease the Bush administration's restrictions, a promise President Obama made good on in March.
Today, with the executive order I am about to sign, we will bring the change that so many scientists and researchers, doctors and innovators, patients and loved ones have hoped for and fought for these past 8 years. We will lift the ban on federal funding for promising embryonic stem cell research.
Of course, it wasn't really a ban, just restrictions. But the scientists attending Mr. Obama's speech were clearly jubilant. So where does all the political to-ing and fro-ing leave the research?
Well, I think we're into an exciting period of time.
Len Zahn is a stem cell researcher at Children's Hospital in Boston. He says there's a lot of exciting basic research being done with embryonic stem cells, but using them to treat patients?
I think that's still a ways off. Although there are some initial studies that the FDA is considering, I think we still need to figure out how to make these cells at a more efficient and effective way, and I think that's going to take still a while. You know, you have to remember the stem cell field is only about 10 years old at this moment.
Zahn points out it's frequently 2 decades or more before new medical technologies find their way into patients. More immediate, Zahn thinks, is finding new drug therapies using a technique made possible by a Japanese researcher named Shinya Yamanaka. He found a way to take ordinary skin cells and turn them into cells that behave just like embryonic stem cells, but without destroying an embryo. The new technique gives scientists unprecedented abilities. For example, they can take cells from a patient with a disease and convert them into these embryonic stem cell-like cells that can grow indefinitely in the lab. Zahn thinks this will change the way scientists understand diseases.
I think that it's going to be possible in certain cases to alter the disease itself with chemicals.
And if a particular chemical can repair disease cells in the lab, then it may be possible to turn that chemical into a drug to treat patients. But even though these new cells offer great promise, Zahn says research using cells derived from human embryos is still essential.
Because these new stem cells from the skin have to be compared to a golden standard, and the golden standard is the embryonic stem cells.
So for the time being, at least, scientists will continue to do research on embryonic stem cells, now in a more permissive environment. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
And now the final installment of our occasional series, Shifting Ground, about America's changing landscape. This is the story of a widow, a farm, and a final request. Independent producer David Barron spent 2 years following one landowner's efforts to use her own death as a way to preserve the land she loves.
Joan Graham has been on this earth 80 years, and in that time, she's acquired a number of things. 2 artificial hips, 2 husbands, whom she outlived, a 157-acre parcel of Michigan woods and farmland, and a passion for the outdoors.
I just like the earth. I like the smell of it, and I like green, and I like trees.
She plants trees around her farmhouse.
This is a tulip tree.
She tends them.
Those are walnut trees.
So she wasn't happy when, a few years ago, trees started coming down on the lot across the road.
It's going to be a subdivision. I hate to think of what it's going to look like.
To protect her land, Joan Graham decided to bequeath it to a local conservation group. The group promised not to develop the property after she's gone. But then she thought, why should she have to go? So she made the following request. When she dies, she wants to be buried on her property, beneath an oak.
They have deep taproots. Well, wouldn't it be nice if that oak tree would ever reach my remains and the tree would take nourishment from that? And it's kind of like, well, I never died, really. I just morphed into a tree or something.
But her request to the conservation group, the Six Rivers Regional Land Conservancy, didn't end there. Donna Foland is the group's executive director.
She said that she would like to share it. She would welcome others who would want to be buried there.
On the farm?
On the farm, yeah.
Had you ever had a property owner make this request to you?
No. No. It was brand new.
And it was not exactly uncontroversial. Joan Graham's proposal was to turn a portion of the farm into a highly unusual cemetery, an environmentally friendly one with no embalming, no fertilized lawn, just bodies interred in biodegradable caskets or shrouds with rocks and trees as grave markers. Donna Foland brought the idea to her board.
The first reactions varied from, oh, that sounds lovely, just an immediate warming to it, to people who thought it was pretty kooky, like maybe we shouldn't be engaged with crazy ideas like that.
But the more Foland thought about the idea, the more excited she grew. You see, one of the challenges of conservation is getting the public to feel invested in protecting land. Foland realized that burying bodies on the farm would make the land sacred, a place people would always want to preserve. But was this plan legal? How would she do it?
Nice to meet you. I'm Donna.
Tom Lynch. Pleasure. Have a seat. Thanks.
For advice, she sought out a prominent Michigan funeral director, Thomas Lynch. They sat in his office, a formal room with dark wood and subdued light.
So you want to take a natural field, woods, and just say, let's put our dead in here. And by doing so, we're sort of upping the conservancy ante.
Mm-hmm.
Because once people have buried their dead, they're disinclined to put, you know, a bookstore there.
Yes, I believe so.
Mm-hmm. That makes good sense.
And
Lynch said no laws barred the idea. Bodies don't have to be embalmed, for instance. But any cemetery would have to meet state regulations. Donna Foland came away energized but cautious.
It's not something that I would be able to do on my own, and that our conservancy certainly would want to do. We need other partners to be in the lead with certain details.
She contacted an organization called the Green Burial Council. It's trying to jumpstart a movement toward more environmentally friendly cemeteries in the U.S. The group's founder, Joe Sihe, came to Michigan, met with Joan Graham on her farm, and agreed to help with the project.
It's a beautiful gift that Joan is giving to a lot of people. Her last act on earth could be incredibly meaningful and could do a lot of wonderful things for a lot of years.
Sihe said what the Land Conservancy needed was a partner in the cemetery business, and he had an idea.
Based on our preliminary research, it seems like one of the most promising possibilities is a partnership with the township.
Joe, my name is Mike Nolan. I'm the attorney for Metamora Township. in the room with me.
With Joe Sihe on the phone, the Conservancy's Donna Folan sat down with local officials last year. She provided some background.
This is a photograph of part of the area where the burial ground is proposed to be in.
Then Joe Sihe made a pitch. What if the township operated the burial ground as an annex to its existing cemetery? He argued the new green cemetery would help protect the land, and it could bring revenue to the town.
If we use the figure of $3,300 per plot, we see $2.3 million coming from that.
The presentation didn't go over well. Township officials declined to speak on tape, but they weren't sold on the concept. Bodies buried in the woods? What if a loved one visiting a grave tripped over a fallen log? Who'd be liable? And Donna Folan says officials were skeptical of the finances.
I could see their side of things. I mean, I think we have to show them more than theoretical numbers that that it, you know, was going to work. So they were not interested in taking on that responsibility.
Donna Folan kept looking for partners. She courted private cemetery operators. Some seemed interested at first, but they too weren't sure in the end that they could make the concept work as a business. Now, more than 2 years since Joan Graham made her request, Donna Folan says fulfilling it has proved surprisingly difficult.
The details are a lot more complicated than I ever expected.
But Donna Folan hasn't given up, and neither has Joan Graham.
I'm determined to go ahead with it.
Though she has changed tactics slightly. She threw a party this fall, an afternoon of wine and hay rides and sing-alongs by the barn.
She knows them all.
Me cansé de rogarle.
It was a harvest festival, but with another purpose. You see, even if Joan Graham can't make a formal green cemetery a reality, she can establish a tiny private one. So that's the plan now. In essence, a family plot up the hill by the woodlot. At the party, she recruited volunteers.
I wouldn't mind if other people joined me up there, as long as they're willing to be a flower or a tree.
Her friends were charmed.
I'm going to be a candidate. I am.
And among the most enthusiastic volunteers was Donna Folan from the Land Conservancy.
If there was a place for me, that would be good. I would like that for myself.
After 2 years trying to sell the concept of green burial, she says she's sold on it herself. For NPR News, I'm David Barron.
Me quiero morir. This night I want to die.
Very good, very good.
The Food and Drug Administration has quietly delayed a reassessment of the chemical BPA. BPA is a widely used additive. It's found in plastic bottles and food containers, and it can mimic the hormone estrogen. Concerns have been raised recently about BPA's safety. FDA officials had promised an announcement by the end of November. NPR's John Hamilton explains what's going on.
Earlier this year, the FDA seemed poised to change its stance on BPA. Many food and beverage containers are made with the chemical. In June, the FDA's new chief, Margaret Hamburg, promised the agency would reconsider its position that BPA is safe. And in August, the FDA's Science Advisory Board held a public hearing on BPA. It included testimony from a lot of people who think the chemical is not safe. Among them, Ellie Collinson of the Breast Cancer Fund.
The science is clear and the time has come to remove this toxic substance from our food supply.
Jennifer Sass of the National Resources Defense Council.
FDA should list BPA as a substance prohibited from the use in human food.
Olga Nydenko of the Environmental Working Group.
We feel that for BPA we don't know enough to take action right now.
And Elizabeth Hitchcock of the U.S. Public Interest Research Group.
The federal government should regulate this and other toxic chemicals to protect our children's health.
The FDA was feeling a lot of pressure. Then, in October, the National Institutes of Health announced that it would spend $30 million on a whole new round of BPA studies. Moreover, the new studies would address some perceived shortcomings in previous research. Since then, the FDA has gone silent on BPA. Its self-imposed November deadline came and went, and the agency has declined to offer an explanation or a new deadline. Sarah Vogel of the Johnson Family Foundation says the prospect of lots of new BPA studies puts the FDA in an awkward position.
How do you make a decision when you want to have, of course, all the information in front of you? You also want to be health protective. You know this research is coming, but some of it's not going to be done for quite a while. So, you know, I think that's probably a difficult issue that FDA is having to weigh.
Vogel is one of several dozen scientists who sent a strongly worded letter to the FDA this fall, urging it to act without waiting for more research. The authors of that letter include many academic researchers who have done studies on BPA, and many of those studies suggest BPA can cause problems like abnormal sexual development, at least in animals. But Vogel says academic scientists generally haven't conducted the sort of studies that government agencies use to assess risk.
You have a scientific community that's asking hypothesis-driven questions. They're not thinking about setting a regulatory safety standard.
That's made it hard for regulators to draw conclusions from these studies. Wolfgang de Kant is a toxicologist at the University of Würzburg in Germany. He was on a panel that reviewed BPA research a few years ago for the European Food Safety Authority. De Kant says the panel looked for studies that met certain criteria.
For example, your study has to be reproducible, your effects have to be consistent, your statistics have to be correct, you have to use larger group sizes.
De Kant says many of the studies just didn't measure up.
In addition, a number of other studies who have tried to repeat or replicate the effect of low-dose studies and who were usually statistically more powerful have not been able to reproduce this data.
Meanwhile, the larger studies, often paid for by industry, found no risk from BPA, even with exposures hundreds of times higher than most people get. So the European Union decided to do nothing. In the U.S., regulators have been frustrated by another feature of these academic studies. Earl Gray, a scientist with the Environmental Protection Agency, says most academic researchers haven't used oral doses in their experiments. Instead, he says, they inject animals with BPA, also known as bisphenol A.
Bisphenol A, when it's injected, bypasses a lot of the liver's metabolism, and so you can see effects that you can't get with oral administration.
That's why regulators like the FDA prefer studies in which animals are exposed to BPA the same way people are, by mouth. The new NIH-funded research should provide more of those studies, and that would make a decision about BPA safety easier. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Conservationists launched an effort this month to save one of the world's rarest creatures, the northern white rhino. Only 8 are known to exist, and 4 of them were at a zoo in the Czech Republic. They've been shipped to Kenya, where scientists hope they'll get down to the business of breeding. Nick Wadhams was there when the animals arrived in Nairobi.
It is 3:30 in the morning at Nairobi's main airport when a 747 jet lands with 8 tons of an extremely rare animal, 2 male and 2 female northern white rhinoceros, packed in wooden crates and lying on straw. These rhinos are headed to the Olpejeta Conservancy near Mount Kenya to see if the climate and the terrain will encourage them to get breeding. Hamish Curry directs the Back to Africa program, which helps return zoo animals to the wild. He prowls the tarmac, directing trucks, tractors, and a giant crane as the animals come off the plane.
The trip went very well. They're all relaxed. All, in fact, very settled. But obviously, we want to get them on the road as soon as possible and reduce their stress. So the trucks are waiting now. And we're going to load 2 onto a truck with a crane, fasten them down, and get out of here.
When no one is looking, I climb atop one of the crates and peek in. A dank, musty stink rises from the rhino, which is lying down and asleep. From this angle, it looks like a giant one-ton slug. It takes 3 hours for a staff of dozens to place the crates on 2 flatbed trucks, and we're off on a 200-mile journey north to the shadows of Mount Kenya. The rhinos were sent to Kenya in a desperate effort to save their subspecies, which was hunted to extinction by poachers in Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo. No northern whites have been seen in the wild since 2005. Dana Holikova is the Czech zoo director who pushed for the relocation. Unlike other rhinos, northern whites breed poorly in captivity. That may have to do with the small zoo enclosures where they live. and these animals will be released into a fenced-off 1,000-acre slice of the conservancy.
In captivity, we bred successfully and perfect with five-generation black rhinos. But of the white rhinos, they are bred only seldom, and nobody knows why. And I'm sure the zoologists will find the key how open this problem. But for the northern white, we have no time. The possibility to start it bred here is more and more better. And that is why this is the last chance for survival. The last chance for the normal breeding, the last chance for the rhino life and the rhino children.
Hours later, it's time at last to release the rhinos into their new pens. Journalists scurry around a crate that dangles and sways from chains held by a rusty crane. Scientists have high hope for this rhino, a 9-year-old female named Fatu, who is in perfect health. When handlers open her crate door, Fatu panics. She wheezes and snorts for her mother, who has already been offloaded. Jan Žarek, Fatu's keeper, who flew in from the Czech Republic, coaxes her out with lullabies and a crust of brown bread. It is panicky, media-saturated scenes like this that some scientists feared. Some rhino conservation groups refused to back the project because of its costs, well into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, and because they thought the trip might kill the animals. All in their pens at last, the rhinos seem calm. That's partly thanks to Barry White, a British rhino handler who helped get the animals used to their crates in the Czech Republic and came along for the journey. She's been dubbed the Rhino Whisperer for her way with the animals.
They do love a lot of fuss and attention and like horses, really, and they really respond to it. So it's been a lot of what we've been doing, really, just making a big fuss of them over the last month. Rhinos respond well to love and being scratched. So the whole sort of aim of the game is to make them as chilled out as possible. So, yeah, that's what I've been doing.
Whatever she did, it seems to have worked. After the frenzy is over, a rhino named Sunyi snuffles around his pen, munching hay and checking out the photographers on the other side of a wooden fence. The question now is whether the females of his own species will express the same interest in him. For NPR News, I'm Nick Wadhams at Olpejeta in Kenya.
Chesapeake Bay is one of the country's most polluted waterways, and that is despite decades of government pledges and several billion federal dollars aimed at cleaning it up. Yesterday, we heard how agriculture contributes to the pollution. Today, the impact of cities and towns. Harmful substances flow into the Chesapeake from urban areas throughout the bay's wide watershed. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren recently spent some time with people in Washington, D.C. to understand how the city affects the bay.
Okay. It's a crisp fall day, and Ann Croft is fertilizing her tiny lawn in Washington, D.C.'s Capitol Hill neighborhood. She always does it this time of year.
Basically, you don't want it to die on you in the winter. So if you fertilize it before winter comes, it allows the roots to get really deep in there and hang on until spring comes.
She reads the bag to figure out how much to use.
Let's see, it's violation of the law. Apply 1.5 pounds of 2 to 4D per acre per application. That's not very clear. So I'm going to have to sort of just wing it. I'll just put a bunch in there, and I'll probably just go back and forth over it a couple of times, and then I'll just call it a day.
Croft knows the bay's polluted. She used to teach fourth grade in Maryland and spent about 2 weeks each year focusing on the Chesapeake. Still, she didn't think she could be part of the problem.
I guess I don't think about where the water runoff goes in the city.
Dottie Younger thinks about it a lot. On a rainy autumn day, she's in Croft's neighborhood watching water run down a sewer.
The stormwater that's collected from last night and through today is running down the street and into the storm drain.
Younger is what's called the river keeper for the Anacostia River, which flows through the east side of Washington, D.C. She's the chief advocate for one of the shortest and dirtiest tributaries of the Chesapeake.
And if anybody has used any pesticide or fertilizer on their lawn, that gets picked up with the rainwater.
Two kinds of pollution are the prime culprits for robbing the bay of oxygen, nitrogen and phosphorus. 10% of the nitrogen and even more of the phosphorus in the Chesapeake come from fertilizers that wash off lawns and golf courses. And fertilizer isn't the only problem. As we motor down the Anacostia in a small boat, Younger explains that in Washington, D.C. and lots of other cities across the Bay watershed, storm water flows through the same pipes as the sewage. When it rains hard, sewage treatment plants can't handle all the volume, so they divert the storm water and the sewage into the rivers.
Every time it rains really hard in the district and you flush your toilet, you are flushing your toilet directly into the Anacostia.
It's raining heavily as we approach the ballpark where the Washington Nationals play. Younger remembers a conversation she once had there.
It was after a particularly large rainstorm, and I remember just something really smelled. And I turned to my husband and I said, "What stinks?" And he said, "Your river stinks." And he was right.
It can take as little as a quarter of an inch of rain for the local utility to release raw sewage and stormwater into the Anacostia. It sends about 2 billion gallons of the untreated stuff into the bay tributaries each year. Altogether, about a fifth of the nitrogen and phosphorus in the bay come from wastewater treatment plants throughout the bay's huge watershed. The Anacostia is an urban river surrounded by asphalt, cobblestone, cement, and other hard surfaces. In undeveloped areas, the earth soaks up the rain and filters the pollution. But in urban areas, there's nothing to absorb the rain or pollution.
So the rainwater hits a parking lot, doesn't get absorbed. It picks up oil or plastic bottles or food wrappers, and then the water either rushes directly off the land, or you can see out of this pipe here off of the Navy Yard, it comes out of some kind of drainage system directly into the river untreated.
About 100 yards away on the bank, we watch a pipe pumping runoff into the river. Then we approach a bridge packed with cars, trucks, and buses.
Those cars are contributing to the pollution that's in the Anacostia and then pollution that is in the Chesapeake Bay.
They leak gasoline and oil onto roads, and the rain washes it into waterways. And they pump exhaust into the air. Exhaust from cars, trains, and factories hangs in the air until it rains, and then pollution comes down with the rain.
That rain just brings the pollution directly into the water.
About a quarter of the nitrogen pollution in the bay comes from the air. Nitrogen and phosphorus stimulate too much algae to grow. Bacteria eat the algae. As the bacteria and algae die, they suck so much oxygen out of parts of the bay that fish and other creatures have to swim away to survive. The algae and sediments in the runoff also make the water murky, killing underwater plants that provide safe nurseries for the bay's famous crabs and many fish. Younger says most people think the rain has a cleansing effect on the environment, but she knows differently.
I used to love a rainy day. Now when it rains, I panic because I know here in the Anacostia, if it rains very hard, that water's going to end up untreated into the river. And then the Anacostia is going to flow into the Potomac, and the Potomac is going to flow into the Chesapeake, and we're going to be adding more pollution into the Chesapeake Bay.
Experts say each of the 17 million people living in the watershed play a role, and the Obama administration says unless the states move aggressively to cut pollution soon, the federal government will crack down. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.